folks. Thanks for tuning in to the Vigilance Press podcast again. This is Mike Lafferty, and with me today I have regular co-host Jason Tondreau, Dr. Comics. How you doing, Jason?
I'm awesome.
All right. You are awesome, sir. And we also have Mr. Dan Abnett, who's one half of the stellar writing team of Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning. How you doing this morning, sir?
I'm doing very well indeed. Thank you very much.
Nice to have you. How's the weather in England?
It's lovely by British standards. It's kind of featureless and grey. But no, it's very nice. Very nice.
That's great. Now, we have featureless and grey here in Colorado, too. It just kind of reminded me of that.
Well, we're in California where it's, you know, 72 and sunny all day long, so.
If it's ever not 72 and sunny, it's like a state emergency there, isn't it?
That's right.
All right. Oh, Mr. Abnett, right off the bat, you are working on Flashpoint for DC, which is kind of the big event right now. Could you talk a little bit about, I understand you and Andy are doing the Wonder Woman and Lois Lane arcs on that particular event.
Yes, that's right. We were invited to participate in Flashpoint by Eddie Berganza and by Geoff Johns, which is very, very flattering to be included in that. Obviously done a lot of work for DC, particularly in the late 90s and the early part of the last decade. And then being exclusive to Marvel for several years, we didn't get to work with them, with DC as either as a universe or as an editorial force. I mean, Eddie is a very good friend of ours, so it's very nice to be invited back and to join in the fun. I dare not say too much about Flashpoint, other than obviously it's a Flash-driven event, and Geoff has masterminded it. But when he first started to tell us about it, we were quite mesmerised at the cleverness of what he'd constructed in terms of the conceit of what the story is all about. That unlike so many events that we've participated in the past for either of the big two or indeed other companies, he had not only worked out a structure, but where he wanted the story to go and how it would end and everything like that, which is quite often, you know, you come up with a great concept and then you'll play about to see where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. This Geoff has got it planned very, very meticulously, and I think it's an enormously satisfying story. We come aboard, as you said, to do two of the miniseries that are part of the Flashpoint event. We're doing Lois Lane and the Resistance is the title of one book, and Wonder Woman and the Furies, which is the title of the other book. Now, Wonder Woman plays a very important part in this event, so we're writing one of the key books, which is lovely. And it's also great to write Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman is one of those iconic characters that we had not really ever properly written before. And that's a lovely thing to do.
Well, now go ahead, Jason.
I got a question for you, Dan. It's interesting that you got tapped to write the two books starring women.
I can't.
Why they picked you for that?
I think because we're obviously clearly in touch with our feminine halves, and obviously very, very metrosexual, being European. I think that's probably those kind of things. No, to be honest, they approached us to write for the event, and they wanted us to write several of the, at least a couple of the miniseries, and essentially we were shown a shortlist. A couple of things have been assigned, and other things, other bits and pieces. Now, I think Eddie was already quite keen on the idea of us writing Wonder Woman because he knew we really would love to have a shot at writing some issues of Wonder Woman. So we sort of penciled in there, and we jumped at the chance. Let's say mainly because she is a great iconic character and a rare iconic, being such an important female superhero.
Well, I bring it up because with my students, you know, we've been talking a lot these last couple of weeks about specifically female superheroes and kind of the unique challenges of writing those characters and, you know, the struggle for audience and can we use it as a way to get more women reading comics or what are the sort of the unique challenges of writing female characters in these books? And I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that now that I guess I do.
We've always tried to feature female characters prominently. And in fact, in some of the other very sort of male-centric things that I write or Andy and I write together, I'm thinking particularly, for instance, of writing for the Warhammer universe, for Games Workshop. I've written a large number of novels there, and it's such a boy-orientated universe, this is the far future, but I try my best to put strong female characters into it, female characters full stop, let alone strong ones, because I like to see that sort of balance and equality in terms of... and indeed, in Warhammer, that's brought female readers to that particular universe, which I think is great. We changed the demographic of the fans, because there were suddenly girls weren't particularly interested in playing the game or painting the figures, but they liked the universe. And when there was fiction with female characters in it that they could identify with, yeah. Game stage we'd have with the boys coming along because they wanted to, and not by boys, I mean males coming along because they wanted to talk about the particular universe fluff and into the figure painting competitions and that kind of stuff. Yeah. But girlfriends and sisters were coming along because they had bought into the universe. Yeah. So. And I have to say that in terms of the DC stuff, which is obviously where this is coming from, Wonder Woman, it was simply the iconic character. But Lois, interestingly, yeah. you picked because she, as far as we're concerned, is one of the other great iconic female characters.
Sure, she is, yeah.
And in many respects, he says, making up a theory on the spot. No, in many respects, Lois is more important than Wonder Woman because Lois is an important female character without having to dress up in a ridiculous costume or possess powers. She's... Right. Woman, she's a reporter. She, you know, it's about her personality and about her professional ability and about her life and all those kind of stuff. And that was much more appealing. And I think I have to say that there is such a danger of being patronizing about female characters, for instance, or anything else where you can sort of compartmentalize them.
Yeah.
You need somehow to write them with. You need to be somehow uniquely qualified to write a particular thing, or be to give them sort of some special emphasis in order to allow them to function and sort of level the playing field against strong popular male characters, for instance. You need to be very, very sensitive to these things. But I think if you're writing professionally, you're a man or a woman. You're writing professionally, and you want to do the good enough job. You engage with them as characters. That's the bottom line. It's not that they're women. It's not like that they're anything yeah. else. It's just they're strong characters, and we're trying to write them to the best of our ability in that regard. Yeah. I worry about that sort of positive discrimination. You know, let's give Wonder Woman a chance because she's a female superhero. Yeah. That's kind of a handicap. And I think what really appealed to us about both of them, which is why we picked them, was that they were strong classic DC characters that we would really relish writing.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we do elsewhere as well, you know.
Right on.
So in the Flashpoint world, the Amazons have, let's see, they've taken over the UK, right?
They have, yes. I think maybe that's one of the other reasons that Eddie asked yeah. us to write the Wonder Woman, to be honest.
You had a whole field advantage.
Yeah, he thought that if anybody could accurately depict the downfall of the UK, it should be people who were living there. It's funny, it's weird in a way that there's so many things that are in Flashpoint, and so I'm not going to, no spoilers here, so don't worry, but there's so many elements of the Flashpoint story are closely related to elements in the world around us right now. It's a very topical story in so many regards. And just the idea that the Amazons need an island as a home, and these are, in Flashpoint, the Amazons are very much the warrior race that they have been in classical mythology. They have not been tempered by civilization. I'm not saying they're not civilized, but they are culturally the ferocious martial warriors of legend.
This isn't the peace and love Amazons.
No. This is exactly. That's part of the point of what Flashpoint is showing you, is what the sort of pure unrefined version is, and they are quite scary. Really, very scary indeed, and that's an angle we're taking with this.
There was an event a couple of years ago, Amazon's attack, where they basically, under the manipulation, I want to say, of Granny Goodness, they attacked the continental United States.
Yeah,
sort of a similar take on them, perhaps.
Absolutely, I think there is that always that underlying idea that they are sort of, as I say, these ferocious creatures of myth. They are sort of Greek warriors in that early pantheon of myths and legends, and have that sort of timeless quality to them, and sometimes we can sort of forget that that's what they are, and I think this serves to remind the DCU of what they are and what they're capable of doing, really.
Well, I'm just going to speak for all of the people listening that are all thinking, I hope that Flashpoint is better than Amazon's attack, right? Because
pass absolutely no judgment on Amazon attacks at all, and just say that it's as good as we're possibly able to make it. So
outstanding.
Consummate professional there, Dan. Okay, just a little background for people who might not be familiar with the DR press storm that's been going on. Atlanteans are at war with the Amazons. Atlantis, under the rule of Emperor Aquaman, has sunk most of Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the backstory. I just picked up the first issue, which came out this last week. And the one thing I noticed was the Green Lantern was Ebon Sur. So yes. Obviously, yeah, that's interesting.
It is indeed. I don't want to overstep the mark by telling you too much, but quite clearly we're not talking about an Elseworld here. We're just talking about a continuity that has been subtly altered by a few key things.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of current versions have been replaced by older versions because Batman is also not Batman.
Yeah, he's Thomas Wayne.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is a sense of this is what the DCU would be like if certain things had happened in a different way, and one of the key things there, as you've mentioned, is that both Atlantis and Amazon, the Amazonians, are these vastly powerful ancient civilizations.
Right.
Both got a warrior code. Both of them have a strange attitude towards, a suspicious attitude towards what might be regarded as surface dwellers or modern culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And circumstances have brought them to the point where their ancient rivalry is threatening and indeed destroying whole chunks of what we would consider to be sort of the modern world. And it's what people are doing in the face of that. And Lois's book, obviously, Lois Lane is the reporter we always knew she was, essentially, and she's sort of a reporter caught in the war zone, seeing what's going on. As the title of her book suggests, Lois Lane and the Resistance. Clearly, we're talking about a character who is in occupied territory and working with people on the inside.
Okay, sounds great. Make sure to check it out. You'd mentioned that you and Andy are also working on the New Mutants right now.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. That's a real treat as well for us. We've long time X fans. I mean, really, really love the X books. I mean, the cornerstone of our growing up as comic book readers, long before we ever knew that's what we'd be doing professionally, was enjoying the X Men. And and there again, our work at Marvel with things like the Cosmic Stories, Annihilators, Guardians of the Galaxy, Nova, and recently with Heroes for Hire, had led us to both meet and get on very well with Nick Lowe, who's the sort of head of the X office, and he invited us to take over New Mutants, which starts on 25, which I think was out last week. And that's just great. It was one of those things where as we obviously said yes, because you don't say no to an offer like that, but when we started to get into it, we realized how fond of these characters we were. It was like, I don't know, like watching a favorite TV show that you hadn't watched in a while. Just the whole idea of engaging with these stories and these characters again. And we're going to take the New Mutants through things like Fear Itself, the Marvel event this year, and we've got some great story ideas and some great artists like David LaFuentes is going to be on board. So it's some really, really terrific things happening there.
Now, which characters, which New Mutants are we talking about here? Which ones do you get to write?
We got the pick of the crop, to be honest. We got basically a box full, a metaphorical box full of all characters who've ever technically been known as the New Mutants.
Yeah.
Which, incidentally, I think it's interesting. The New Mutants is, of course, just the name of the comic. They're not officially they don't call themselves the New Mutants within the context of the book. They are a team of X-Men. The comic is New Mutants, like Detective Comics and action comics. But in terms of characters who fall under that New Mutant category, we got to pick up the continuity as it was running currently, choose which ones kept on the team, which ones we moved to the side and sort of retired for a while, you know, basically put them back on the bench for a bit.
Yeah.
So we have a team moving forward where they are engaged in their particular remit, which is the story that we open with, is called Unfinished Business. And their remit is that Cyclops wants them to try and investigate and tidy up loose ends, at what might be regarded as loose ends in X-Men continuity, because they never get a chance to. The X-Men community. Rushing from one crisis to another, and things happen, and they don't get a chance to finish this off or that off. And quite often, these threats come back to haunt them twice as badly as they were the first time.
That's right.
So the New Mutants, in inverted commas, their remit becomes is kind of cleaning house, tidying up, going to look for missing mutants, trying to sort out problems, head off crises before they become, you know, catastrophic things again. And well, that allows us to play around in a big sort of box full of fun of characters and loose ends and things that people have been dying to see.
Yeah, that gives you an excuse to sort of wander back through continuity and do a kind of revisit all of your favorite stories.
Yeah, favorite stories, favorite characters. I have to say that when they first trailed this, we got an awful lot of great response from New Mutants readers, X-fans generally, saying, are you going to do this? Who's going to be on the team? Who's going to be doing this? And when Marvel announced their first mission of unfinished business is to go and locate X-Man, Nate Gray, they kind of went crazy. So we obviously hit upon something right there to start off with. And we've had, I have to say, frankly, some of the nicest comments from readers about our first issue that we've ever... Andy and I have been... I think this year is his 25th year in comics and my 24th year. And so almost 50 years between us, we've been working in the comics industry. And we've had some very nice comments overall. But that issue got some... just genuinely heartfelt, lovely comments from people, and I was just so delighted.
Yeah,
thank you.
So you will be explaining Zorm, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. yes, I think Nick's idea is that we will explain all the difficult stuff that has never been explained. So
I was just messing with you, but if you want to, that'd be great. Okay. Hey, and you and Andy recently wrote Thor and Iron Man God Complex, which is recently released in hardcover.
It has. It's just coming out right now, I think. I haven't seen a copy of it. That was great. Scott Eaton's such a fantastic artist. And that also was born out of working on the Cosmic books and being able to do stupendously big things, you know, ridiculously planet-crushing events. And Ralph Macchio said to us, could you take... Obviously, Thor and Iron Man being two of the highest profile of the movie franchise at the moment. Can you take them, put them together, give us a miniseries that really plays up on the sheer awesomeness of them as characters, that they have these you know, there's two of the most powerful characters on the roster. So we devised this structure around them. I think it's a cracking story. We kind of wanted to do something that was very old school. It was as simple a storyline. It's all about huge action and huge concepts, and, you know, so the creation of a new pantheon of gods. We've got the high evolutionary wanting to change the destiny of the world and roping in various sort of super powerful henchmen like Ulrich the Troll and the Crimson Dynamo, and it's a story full of symmetries, because everything that Thor brings to the table, there is the equivalent Iron Man thing, and it's all balanced out. So there's some great things there, and also one of our all time favourite Marvel villains. We love High Evolutionary, I have to say, although I don't think he's technically a villain. He's just an entity. He's one of those characters like Kang or Immortus who'd be a good guy or a bad guy depending on the circumstance. But in an effort to pursue his particular scheme, High Evolutionary has employed Diablo. Now, Diablo is such a great villain. He's so completely over the top. He's fantastic. And we had enormous fun with him. So we've got the Destroyer armor in there. We've got dragons. We've got Volstagg. We've got cats and dogs living together. We've got everything.
I was really hoping for a scene where Thor was like, Tony, all is forgiven because I have this Tony clone who hangs out in hangs out in Asgard and fetches mead for me. So all is forgiven, sir.
Yes, no, well, that almost. I have to say, I mean, one of the things we did in a gentle way, we wanted to make sure that it wasn't one of these sort of, hey, let's cash in on a movie by doing a story that's got both of these characters in it that could be set anywhere stories. What we tried to do is one that we rested gently in current continuity. So Asgard has fallen. They're trying to rebuild it. Stark's helping out. Iron Man and Thor are not getting on terribly well because of what's been going on. And the story goes from there. So it's not utterly dependent upon local continuity, which means it, you know, is a standalone story that can work anywhere. However, if you're reading Iron Man and Thor at the moment, you're not going to go, well, what the hell's happening here? And how did we get there? You know, we just tried to rest it in that foundation so that it made some kind of sense.
That's cool.
Hey, do you have any comments about the Thor movie, or have you seen it yet?
I was meant to see it on Wednesday, and I couldn't, so I'm going to go and see it this week. My daughter got to see it last night, and she's determinedly not telling me anything about it. But,
like a good girl.
Absolutely. As an unashamed fan of the Australian soap opera Home and Away, which I am, after my sins, I know I've been watching Chris Hemsworth in that for years. So I'm looking forward to him as Thor.
Is that why the film opened in Australia about 2 weeks previous to America? Is because of his connection?
Quite probably, yes. It quite probably did. Yeah, he's a sort of major star over there, and of course he's George Kirk as well, isn't he?
He's in
the Abrams film, yeah. But Home and Away is one of those half-hour daily soaps. I guess it's like I don't know what the American equivalent. In Britain we have Neighbours and Home and Away, which have been going for years, and they're sort of daily soaps, and they're mindlessly attractive and very, very funny and sort of hearted, and they tend to get shown at lunchtime. So as a freelancer who works at home, I work all morning, I stop for a sandwich, I stick the television on and get the news, and then there's Home and Away or Neighbours. And I've become addicted, unfortunately. and so when the star of one of these, it couldn't be further away from Thor, to be honest, but when the star of one of these ends up in playing Thor, I'm going, wow, there's some kind of weird synchronicity at work in the universe.
I want to ask you about how you... I'm sorry. Mike, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, the synchronicity is no matter what I do, even when I break for lunch, I can't escape from comics.
That's right. I wanted to ask you about, like, the way that you write. I mean, you've been writing for so long, like you say. You know, I do a lot of work with students, and so I'm mostly teaching them writing. And so I'm very curious, kind of, what's your writing process? I mean, when you get in the day, how do you write, and how do you go back and revise your own work? And
a number of different ways, because of course I do a lot of different things. Some of the things I do alongside Andy, some of the things I do on my own. I write comics, I write screenplays, I write novels. I mean, I'm just writing now my 39th novel, coming out from this year. So I wear a number of different hats. I used to be a terrible one for working late into the night. I would just keep chasing a deadline until it was done. And a couple of years ago, I had suffered from some seizures, and it was all very scary. I didn't know what was going on, and my doctor didn't know what was going on, and I went to the hospital for tests. And it turned out that I was one of those very rare people who had simply developed epilepsy quite later on in life.
Wow.
I never had a sign of it before in my life, but I was suffering from epilepsy. So that's fine. But it basically meant that I had to sort of clean my act up, because the things that set off epilepsy are things like alcohol and caffeine and stress and tiredness. So I basically got rid of those things to the best of my ability. I don't drink caffeine anymore. I can't get rid of stress completely because of the nature of any kind of work. But I've taken to sort of I don't work evenings anymore. I certainly don't work into the night. I always get a really good night's sleep, which means that I now wake 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning filled with the most enormous amounts of energy. I was never a morning person, but I'm leaping up before it's light in the morning, and I get to work, and I spend my mornings working on the novels. I try and do about a minimum of about 3,000 words before lunch of the novels. I have an office at home, yeah.
Yeah.
So I commute down the stairs, and it's in the basement. It's like Gollum's cave, and I sit down there, and I work on novels for minimum 3,000 words. So I have a novel ongoing all the time. Have some lunch. After lunch, I switch to comics, and write a minimum of 5 or 6 pages of comic script. And quite often, it's more than that. But if I get that much done in a day, I feel that I'm doing pretty well. Yeah. And it's discipline of doing that. Well, 5 days a week. I have to say, since Christmas, I've been doing that 7 days a week, because we had a lot of deadlines. So I've been a very, very busy year. But I find that I do better work on everything if I move between things very quickly. I never stay on something so long that it gets completely stale. So in fact, a lot of people find it very crazy. They don't kind of understand how I can sort of flit around so much. But the simple answer is, I produce better work when I'm A, slightly under stress, under pressure to deliver. And B, if I'm moving between things, because therefore nothing ever gets that opportunity to sort of slow down. Yeah. And once a week, I mean, I talk to Andy every day. He lives about half an hour away from me, but we get together on a regular basis. We brainstorm stuff, and then we divide up the stuff we're doing. And he might go and plot or beat sheet stuff, and I might plot or beat sheet stuff, and then we'll get together and work stuff together. I'd love to say that when we work together, I type the consonants and he types the vowels. It's not. It's not as seamless as that. Because obviously, as you know, Andy is also an inker, highly regarded inker in the comic industry. So when we're not working together, he's inking and I'm writing novels. And then we get together and do the comic stuff together. And we do that because being a freelancer can be an incredibly lonely thing to do. There are so many freelancers seems to get sort of stir crazy, like cabin fever. So early on when we first met way back at Marvel UK back in the 80s when I was on staff and I was editing The Real Ghostbusters and he was an artist on The Real Ghostbusters. And we got to know, we realized, you know, just sitting in the pub and chatting that we liked the same characters and grown up reading the same sorts of things. And sort of story ideas flew from there and we started to sort of basically hawk these around to companies like Marvel and sell them. And when we started to sell them, we realized we'd then have to write them. So we had to find a way of writing them together. And when you've been doing that for a few years and it's fun, you keep doing it. And we keep doing it because we enjoy doing it so much. And producing work together. I think we sort of push each other further than each one of us would go independently.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Also because it's contact. We speak regularly, we get together regularly, and we work on stuff, and it fends off that cabin fever for both of us that afflicts so many people in industries like comics, where you're a freelancer working on your own in a cave underground.
Yeah, like Gollum.
Hey, you used one phrase I want to ask you about. I think I know what it is, but just to clarify, when you say beat sheet, what are you talking about?
Beat sheet, quite often, the quickest way of getting an editor to sign off on an issue or something so you can write it is to break it down into a series of beats. These are the key elements that you're going to be covering in an issue. So it's almost like a page by page breakdown, but it might be slightly looser than that. And either one of us can produce that, and then either one of us can write up a plot or full script from that point. But it's in rather than putting an idea in and then getting approval to go and then writing a whole script and then discovering that there's a problem with it and you've got to rewrite, quite often we'll submit a quick beat sheet to make sure that the editor likes the look of, gets a real hands-on idea about what they're about to get, you know, how much of it's going to be action, what the key beats that we're going to cover is. And sometimes it's a very useful, it's much easier to write a plot or a script from that.
Yeah,
because we consolidated it together, and it's basically like a roadmap of what the issue should be. So there's lots of little sort of, and they're interchangeable words for things like that. Sometimes we do an outline, plot, pitch, beat sheet, depending on the level of detail that we're covering. But they're documents that, because we work together, we can exchange, and we both know where we stand with something. You know.
Yeah.
So
that must be really important for your cooperation to get the.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I mean, I think it's terrible. If two people work together and they do half as much work, or they do the work that one person could do twice as inefficiently, if you see what I mean.
Right.
two people working together, we would at least want to do one and a half times what one person could do. Otherwise, there's kind of missing out on the opportunities. So that kind of, these things have evolved over 20 years, and we do them, and it means we can, touch wood, remain pretty efficient. You know, we can have a conversation on a Monday morning and say, right, you know, you do that and that, I'll do this and this, and I'll meet you on Thursday, and we'll have covered so many bases. Or you talk to that editor, I'll talk to this editor, that kind of stuff. It's just, you know, make use of the fact there's two of you
What a fortunate team that is. I mean, that's just...
Yeah.
Just so wonderful. Yeah.
Hey, Dan, a couple of fanboy questions before we wrap up.
Fine.
When's Resurrection Man coming back?
Well, that's not a question I can answer accurately, yeah. But I do think you need to realize that because, you know, the clue's in the title, Resurrection, you know, his superpower is to come back. So at some point he's going to have to, isn't he, really?
Yeah. I've been really enjoying Annihilators, and especially thanks for shining some spotlight time on the Space Knights.
My pleasure.
How has that series been received? Are we going to see some more there, or is it too early to say?
I think the intention is to do some more of it. I mean, I think if the market had been more robust, we may have launched it as an ongoing, in the same way we did with things like Guardians. But to do it as a limited series, test the water and then go again, I think is the wisest way. I've had great feedback on it. It seems to have gone down very well. So has the Rocket and Groot backup. Actually, I have to say that sort of double header, where you've got two full issues of things each issue, is I think a very very generous thing of Marvel to do. And the Rocket and Groot art, Tim Green drawing Rocket and Groot for that, I just think it's rare for me to. We can write. I mean, it's a lighthearted script. Obviously, it's got a talking raccoon and a walking tree in it. It's lighthearted, but so it's full of gags. But when the artwork came back before it was lettered, the artwork was making me laugh. Tim had drawn things in such a way that the joke was inherent in expression and posture and attitude and storytelling. And I think that's very, very clever. It's very, very clever to draw something that is intrinsically funny before you've lettered in all the writer's dreadful jokes. So I hope that gets a nice audience. I'd love to see that collected and more people reading it.
Well, it kind of segues into my next two questions. Number one, do you think sci-fi is kind of inherently a hard sell to comics fans? And branching off that, number two, are we going to be seeing more Guardians of the Galaxy sometimes in the near future?
I'll answer the second part first. I don't know. I'd love to. We it's one of the most satisfying things we've ever written was Guardians. It was absolutely our kind of book. Just that kind of mismatch of characters and the sort of crazy things you could do with it. So I'd love to get the chance to do it. The cosmic books, as you say, are a hard sell, and we deliberately ended Guardians and Nova where we did because we didn't want to get them cancelled out from under us. We'd rather reach a proper definitive storytelling end stop and then play it out as we did into Thanos Imperative. So there was at least a sense of us having some control over what we're doing. I'd hate to be halfway through a series, you know, a six-part story, and then suddenly be told that we've got to wrap it up because that's it, folks. So I'd rather quit while you're ahead and then build up the momentum, maybe through the Annihilators, to bring some of those characters back in, or even relaunch Guardians. That would be fantastic. Cosmic, I don't know. This may be a European or even, I have to say, even British sensibility. But to me and Andy, the superheroes that work the best are either the non-superpowered vigilante street heroes, like, well, I say non-superpowered, but, you know, like the Punishers and Daredevils of this world, because they're kind of credible. Or they're the cosmic ones, where they're not guys in costumes. They're creatures in costumes that aren't anything to do with Earth culture. Do you see what I mean? So I don't think of Nova, for instance, as being a guy in a superhero costume. I think of him as being a space cop in armor.
Well,
and
see, this
that's
is
what he wears.
Your 2000 AD is showing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you grew up reading that and Rogue Trooper and all those characters, and so of course, you know, that's
And that's what I mean about it being a very European. I mean, a lot of sort of apparent superhero stuff in that's produced in Europe and the UK. Is very science fiction in origin. I mean, you mentioned Rogue Trooper, you mentioned Judge Dredd. Even if you think about Captain Britain, Captain Britain is a Marvel superhero. He's also a guy wearing the armor of his brotherhood. He's not putting on a costume to disguise his identity. He's wearing the uniform of his armed forces, as it were.
Thanks to Alan Moore.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, yeah.
And so, yeah, the 2000 AD, I mean, I've been writing for 2000 AD for 15 years as well. So, I mean, in fact, weirdly, the characters I write for 2000 AD are the least costumed. I mean, I created the series Sinister Dexter there, which is about two hitmen who actually don't wear costumes. So it's weird that I vent my interest in inverted commas, realistic characters in the one place that I could get away with doing science fiction ones. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons we jumped on the cosmic stuff. We Andy and I had grown up loving Jim Starlin's work on Warlock and Captain Marvel and that kind of stuff.
Wow, yeah.
And we wanted to embrace that stuff where you could write full-blown, huge concept superhero stuff, but the characters weren't, essentially, as it were, weren't superheroes in that sense of spandex and neoprene.
Yeah.
You know, they were powerful, godlike alien beings existing in a kind of cosmic landscape, where these extraordinary things were still extraordinary, but they were part of a big cosmic scope. I mean, there's something lovely about a character like, you know, Superman landing in the middle of Metropolis or Spider-Man swinging across the rooftops of New York, because the juxtaposition there is, oh my gosh, that's completely unearthly and amazing, and that's part of that. But what we quite like is writing stories where the environment is as amazing as the people in it, and they are absolutely science fiction stories. Now, that I think almost everybody can enjoy, but I think there is a lot of the comic market who looks at it and go, "It's a cosmic book. I'm not going to like it." They just dismiss it because it doesn't conform to what they see as a superhero thing. I wish more people would give it a chance, because I think if you read an issue or two of Guardians or Nova or Annihilators or whatever it is, you'll go, oh, wait a minute, I get this, and I get why this is a different kind of fun. When we were first commissioned to do Nova and Guardians of the Galaxy, Joe Quesada, his catchphrase was, "I don't get cosmic." He tried and he couldn't get cosmic. And he just said, "I don't know why these books work. I don't know why they have a following, but I'm quite happy to recognize they do and let you guys run with it." In fact, that's one of the reasons that Jack Flagg in the latter issues of Guardians of the Galaxy kept saying, I hate cosmic stuff. He was basically voicing Joe Quesada's.
You know, it's funny because, I mean, Kirby wrote, you know, the Fourth World and all this New God stuff. And, I mean, if it's good enough for Kirby, you'd think it would be good enough for anybody.
Yeah, really. I mean, in some respects, weirdly, when you put a lot of science fiction into superhero comics, as we do in the cosmic books, you end up sort of meeting fantasy coming the other way.
Yeah.
Because although it's got technology in it, mm-hmm. We're talking about sort of imagined universes where fantastically speaking, almost anything can happen. And mm-hmm. I think you know where they meet in the middle is Earthbound conventional superhero stories, which of course is the bread and butter of both Marvel and DC. You know, that's the environment that most people like, the reassurance of understanding how the environment works and then being confronted by something extraordinary. And I think if you just throw yourself into it, a character like Warlock or Nova or Captain Marvel or the Legion of Superheroes, or you know, and let's face it, Green Lantern is enormously popular for DC now. So clearly there is an increased interest in what might be regarded as cosmic superheroes. I mean, there's no two ways about it. I'm delighted by the trailers for Green Lantern, because now they've got the special effects added, they look to me like a proper cosmic superhero story going on.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I appreciate your time, Mr. Abnett. Anything else you want to cover before we call it a day?
If I've answered all your questions, I'm fine.
Thanks for all of your time, sir. This is just wonderful to talk to a writer who's got so much time in the business and whose work is so well regarded. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks.
All right. Well, hey, thanks for everyone tuning in, and we'll talk to you next podcast.